families of the neighborhood, the working class, the strike. All of these things were foreseen through, if you like, the new speed of time. They were perceived above all through the communication revolution. And why? Because that ties in again with positivism itself. For positivism, the communications revolution seemed devastating. Why? Well, let me read you Max Nordau's attack on the new revolution, the new communications revolution to which I am now coming, the new speed of time. Max Nordau, in his Degeneration, by the way, these are the chief positivist books. Nordau's Degeneration and Hexen, they go together, as I discussed it together. Nordau wrote as follows. Humanity can point to no sense in which the inventions which penetrate so deeply, so tyrannically into the life of every individual are crowded so thickly. The discovery of America, the Reformation, stirred man's mind powerfully, no doubt, and certainly destroyed the equilibrium of thousands of brains which lacked the staying power. But they did not change the material life of man. He got up, lay down, ate and drank, dressed and amused himself, passed his days and years as he had always done. In our times, on the contrary, steam and electricity have turned the customs of life of every member of civilized nations upside down, even of the most obtuse and narrow-minded citizens, who is completely inaccessible to the impelling thoughts of the time. All these activities, that is, steam and electricity, much more dangerous, all these activities involve an effort of the nervous system. And here you have the connection that positivism believed that any revolt against bourgeois society was due to a loss of nerve, fraying of nerve, in physical explanation. Obvious. Just as I've told you before, the doctor, the physician, was becoming king. And every moral explanation were physical as well. So it shouldn't surprise that the explanation for modern art and modern culture, expressionism and all of this, was that they couldn't see straight. Their nerves were frayed. Yes? Their nerves were afraid. They had diseases of the eyeball. That's why the expressionists or Nordau came the way they did. Yes? Their nerves were afraid. And if the youth attacked manners and morals like Weyden, his nerves were afraid. Just as if you were a gay or, well, that was too far out. But let's say if you behaved contrary to the sexual mores, you were sick and you were no longer sent to a priest, but you were sent to a doctor. It's the same kind of materialism as lobotomy, which I mentioned last time with Broca, that you have here. Every line we read or write, every human face we see, every conversation we carry on, every scene we perceive through the window of a flying express, I'll come back to that in a minute, sets in activity our sensory nerves and brain centers. Even the little shocks of railway traffic, not perceived by consciousness, the perpetual noise and the very sight of trains exhaust our nerves. Although, quite rightly, modern art and culture, expressionism, impressionism, futurism, was due to the debilitating of railway travel, and in this he was more right than he knew. For one thing, railway travel is the birth of the communication revolution. Railway travel is the bicycle, and it is to both that I now want to address myself. First to railway travel, and then to the bicycle, because they, together, in the 1950s, made the communication revolution. Now it's clear that the effect of railway travel was not so much the noise and the dirt, but that it required a new way of looking at nature. The challenge of railway travel was the challenge of nature. Let me put it very simply to you. When Goethe went to Italy by coach, of course, in 1798, he describes the landscape and everything. But Goethe, in traveling to Italy behind in a coach and horses, also describes the things that you can no longer do in railway travel. In fact, in railway travel, you don't really see the landscape as Goethe saw it at all. You are, in fact, alienated from nature. Now, this important fact, I can't tell you how important that is, means that the immediacy of nature drops away. When Goethe went through the Alps, you know, in a coach and horses, nature was immediate. Not only did bad pavement have immediate effects, yet, of a bad kind, and not only couldn't you travel in rain, and you were delivered to the seasons, but the trees and the bushes and the flowers and the pavement, you saw everything. But now, you see almost nothing. You are alienated from nature. The immediacy drops away. Nature, therefore, is abstract. Nature is abstract. The consequences of this are very important. I quote to you from a medical British journal. Now again, it is the doctor who diagnoses this disease. Notice, not the priest, but again the doctor. We are in the age of positivism. I quote to you from the English medical journal, The Lancet, of 1862. The speed and the difference of impression in railway travel, fatigue necessarily the eye and the brain. The constantly changing distance of the thing viewed means adjusting constantly. And the retina of the eye must constantly sharpen itself, and the brain must constantly adjust. This is tiring, extremely tiring. And therefore, it follows that our brain begins to disintegrate and our eyes begin to lose their focus. And that is, of course, Max Nordau's explanation and the Nazis' explanation of modern art. That is, of course, the explanation of expressionism, impressionism, and of the revolt of Vedic Vedicin as well, of course, of both of these things. But there is another reaction. There's another reaction, and I quote again from another medical journal. Boredom is the consequence. Boredom is the consequence. Because all attempts to look at nature in the traditional way will not do in the railway, because we are tired too quickly. So the consequence is boredom. Now, what did that mean? It meant something you all know about. It meant the rise of a certain literary genre, of a novel. W. H. Smith in England still exists. The railway booksellers were founded in 1862. W. H. Smith, the railway bookseller. So in a railway, you no longer look at landscape, lost its meaning. You read, and you read a certain type of literature, usually a shallow novel of entertainment. It gave a great up to popular literature. But quite apart from that, it fuels to the search for the immediate. The search for the immediate. Everything is now mediated. You don't have any more immediate experience. This is not only railway travel. These are cities. This is positivism. This is the tribal household, the ritual and manners and morals. So you can understand a young generation, which already grew up in that age, looking for the immediacy of experience, which indeed they were deprived of, not only by railway travel, but also by positivism, by the ritualized manners and morals, by the whole matter of tribal. You will say tribal is the opposite of immediacy, of experience. That, I think, is clear as well. You have, therefore, a common dilemma. The bicycle. The bicycle was regarded, like the railroad, as a matter of undue speed. Still is in medicine. Until 1891, the streets of Berlin were closed to cyclists because of their undue speed and their danger to the horse-drawn streetcars and everybody else. And indeed, always till 1914, when a bicyclist met the emperor, he had to dismount. Now, if we look, therefore, at the bicycle a little closer, we find this. Let us look at the most important book about cycling of 1891. It is all around the same period. It defines this daring activity as one of youth which disturbs the traditionalism of old men and women. That is to say, cyclism is a part of the revolt of youth against age. This speed, individualized as it is another sign of it. Indeed, when the French Cyclist Association was founded in the 1870s, what does its first manifesto say of the first Cyclist Association of 1870? It defined itself in the first paragraph as an enemy of routine. In other words, opposite to the railroad, the cycle was a way to capture speed, to enjoy speed, because it was individualized. It became a matter of the revolution of youth against a positivism. It was concerned an enemy of routine. That, I think, we must not forget. And indeed, all of this new speed of time, which meant then first a loss of immediacy, as you have it in railroad, and second, and a threat that no doubt puts it to the nerves, a threat to getting up early in the morning and going to bed early and striving and persevering, all the things that I read you from no doubt. Railway journey are a threat, not only because you lose the landscape, because your nerves are frayed, and your eyeballs are distorted, and all of this. And secondly, the new speed of time can be taken as a revolt, as cycling was from its beginning, as distrusted again, as a revolt used against their elders. And in this case, a kind of idea of recapturing the immediacy of experience. But again, with the cycle, it isn't really recapturing the immediacy of nature. It is really enjoying speed, recapturing the immediate experience through accepting speed, as nature will do in a philosophical level, the bicycle does, if I can put it that way, on an individual level. Enjoying speed, accepting speed in other minutes to their elders, obviously, of the menaces that I have mentioned. Here also, I must now mention a third factor, the beginning of mass tourism. For if the railways deprive the immediacy of nature, so does mass tourism. And both of them important. I'll tell you why it's important right now, perhaps. You may not gather how important all this is. It's important then because the quest for immediacy of experience, which is so obvious in our world, where everything is mediated, computerized, impersonalized, this begins now. This is the first generation of a society of positivism where immediacy is deprived. Immediacy is deprived very largely by the communication revolution. This is deprived very largely over us by the computer revolution. So don't underestimate the role that technology here plays in depriving. And the result is that the youth want to get back to immediacy. Or spirit, or excitement. And so you can mount on your bicycle in 1891 and cycle in the Berlin suburbs, the center of the city was close to you. But you can cycle in the Berlin suburbs, but you can also write expressionist verse. You can also write poetry. You can also become a futurist. And in the end, of course, you become an intrigue. That's how it works. But something else happens as well. Nature is recaptured. People cannot be without nature. But nature is recaptured, and to which this I come now, integrated. But it's recaptured not as something immediate experience, but an experience which you form. That is to say, mass tourism defines nature. Nature does not define mass tourism. In other words, to the appreciation of nature by the railroad, we must add now mass tourism. For it meant not only, again, the rapid change of nature, it was of course combined with railway travel always to get there. It meant not only that, it meant also again speed and movement. It meant again, remember, a certain kind of restlessness. That too, I think, you must not forget. Now the importance here is, and it's something very difficult to ask, when in the 19th century does mass pilgrimage become mass tourism? So the difference between pilgrimage and tourism is, I think, essential for you to remember. Pilgrimages are things with an aim. The biggest pilgrimages ever in the 19th century. Well, of course, as you all know, to the Holy Grotto of Lourdes, you know, it involved already 300,000, 400,000 descending of this famous grotto of Lourdes for cures, faith healing, and all of that sort of thing. But I think we must define tourism differently. Let us define tourism as, in fact, it was defined in France first in 1876. Tourism, we are told, is one who travels out of curiosity and simply la plaisir de voyage, pleasure of traveling. Now, that is something different. Because in the 17th and 18th century, you traveled for culture. Tourism went to Italy to see the classics, the classical ruins. Yes? Later on in the 19th century, you traveled to make religious pilgrimage to a holy shrine to get cured. But by 1874, it changed. And you travel for curiosity. And you travel, as it were, out of simple dictionary. Out of simple pleasure. And in that same year, 1876, the Oxford Dictionary had a new definition of travel, one who travels of tourism. A new definition of tourism, one who travels for pleasure. Now, we can trace it, I suppose. We can trace it to the foundation, if you like, of what we might call the first tourist office in 1851, Thomas Cook and Son. But first, to take advantage of the railroad. But already, really, for excursion. The first tours of Thomas Cook and Son were railroad excursions within England. But then, by 1855, Thomas Cook and Son already had tours of the continent of Europe. By 1857, you have the first Alpine Club. I'll come back to that in a minute. You have the first Alpine Climbing Club Paul for his son. And the first cook's tour of Switzerland is in 1883. And by 1870, the Swiss vacation industry is safely established, and the character of the Swiss as well, I dare say. So, what you have therefore here is an evolution of mass tourism. Now, what does this mass tourism mean? I think the French historian of myth, Ronald Burt, put it excellently. The landscape becomes tailored to tourism. And what interests in the landscape is what? What interests is the picturesque, meaning the mountains, the tunnels, and plains, only if they are fertile. People become types, the happy busks, the adventurous sailor, the Levantine, the happy gardener. Everything is monumental, and everything monumental is Christian, and everything, of course, is for sale. Now, all of this is true, but I think one must say several more things about it. First of all, as with railway travel, the landscape for the tourist is very formed by the tourist. He categorizes, he takes its state. Mountains are only nice if they are sweet, or at least if they can be dominated. If not by climbing, then eventually by, of course, funicular. But nature is for domination. Nature is for domination by outdoor climbing or else. Therefore, it's still installed. It's not frightening. If you can go up and dominate it, the outdoor club helps you. That's no longer really something quite different. It's you who form nature. Now, this is, of course, true also for people. People do become types for tourists, a very expressive type, the happy, the busker, the Levantine, all of that sort of thing, the gardener. But the thing that I want to point out to you is that tourist is, of course, a nostalgia trip. It is another way to escape, really, from the lack of immediate, from modern industrial society, an escape from innocence. You go to the mountains. It's the Swiss holiday which takes off. It's the Swiss holiday which is the first big holiday. You go to the Swiss lake village. It's impossible. You watch a milkmaid do her thing, yeah? Or you a mountain maid, or God knows what. In other words, it's a kind of 18th century capturing of innocence, but not in the 18th century way. Because in tourism, you make your own innocence. You project your own stereotype, yes? You project your own stereotype on the milkmaid, who, as far as you know, has never been a virgin. So, you project your own type on all of that, quite obviously. Now, what then is the importance of this, all of this? Tourism has, therefore, the importance of nature and the importance of a certain typology, which you find in the early tourist guides, like Yves Bleu in France. But tourism is also now mass tourism. So it is an escape in the security of others. Therefore, in a way, tourism is not an option out of the bourgeoisie. Because in a sense, you can escape in mass tourism through the loneliness of nature. But it is nature, if I put it that way, tribalized. Like the paintings in the wall of Jenny Trice. It is nature co-opted. It is nature made orderly. It is nature which is there for domination. We'll see much more about that. It is nature which can be coped with. It is orderly. You go there in company. You don't go there alone. The facilities are there. And all of that. You have nature in company. Now, I'm not knocking it, that is the nature, only nature I like. But that's either here or there, then I am a happy bourgeois. And when I live on these exercises, I want to lay down and sleep, which is the only sensible way of coping with these matters. But I would never think of not staying in a virtual arts hotel. But the thing is, that obviously this isn't for immediacy of experience. And youth longs for immediacy of experience. So again, you have a dialect. You have the speed of time because you have mobility. You have the dialect, but at the same time, you have the speed co-opted. And therefore, stored by you. Therefore, the bicycle by you. All right, a final invention of great importance, the telephone. Something that may have been invented with the new industrialization, and if I touch by Anderson in Germany, that's going out with it as well, collapsing. Never mind. The telephone. Now, how did they regard the telephone? The first telephone exchange, 1896. How did they regard the telephone? The telephone was regarded as another way of traveling. In other words, as another way of uprooting yourself, as another way of traveling. I can't say much more about it because the social history of the telephone remains to be written, so does the social history of tourism by and large. There's nothing good at all in the history of tourism, nothing at all. You have to get it together here and there, and there's nothing whatsoever about the impact of the telephone. But we know that the impact was very great, and we know that people thought of it as another way of traveling, rather than communication, because they did not fit in the way. And the first telephone, as you know perhaps, were used to transmit theater and music. They were used as transmitting entertainment, very largely. And it didn't until the new century that they were used for what they use now, gossip. So, what you have there for, let me summarize it this way. You have in the communications revolution then, first of all, abstraction against immediacy, and therefore the need for myth, the need for mediation, as good for they, but also of unuse, the need for immediacy. Because you always have to draw the sting of technology. When I come to flying, which I will eventually, it starts in our period but slower, it's always the chivalry of flying, because it's not so frightening if you think of the pilot as a knight and think of flying as the conquest of the air. You put it in a familiar framework of chivalry. So the new technology can be co-opted like the chivalry of flying to draw its stick, to draw its flight. Or it can be enjoyed. It can be enjoyed and taken by you, accepted, as it were, as we do. Secondly, there grows out of that the problem of boredom for the younger generation. Boredom is really, I think, the main motor of modern art and culture, the main motor of youth revolutions, either now or in the 1960s. Anyhow, you don't underrate boredom as a matter for a reason. So, it's a boring society. You want immediacy. All right? You have restlessness, but the restlessness is co-opted. I read cheap novels in railways, or mass tourism. But you don't want to be co-opted. You enjoy the rest. Jump on your bicycle and make Berlin unsafe. Right? Now, out of that comes what we call the avant-garde in literature and art. That is to say, those who become the pioneers of the new form of literature and art, whom the positivists regarded, and I must make that clear again, regarded as physically the form. Doctor, railway traveler, nurse. I've gone beyond this, of course, in this analysis. The need for excitement and restlessness. Now, again, I've illustrated the eugenic triad. If you look at page 190 and 91, all Jenny Tribal. You have seen that Jenny Tribal satisfied her restlessness by tourism, by travel. Now notice something else about her. Not only does Jenny Tribal co-opt her restlessness to a bourgeois lifestyle. Yes, am I putting it that way? Not only does Jenny Tribal co-opt her restlessness to a bourgeois lifestyle through travel, but notice it, notice, she travels to many places. Part of it kind of restless. Nature is mediated. You don't even stay in Saint-Mars for a month. You go from one place to another. Mars tourism is in a way like another railway travel for Jenny Tribal. You go from one place to another, so you no longer have the immediacy of nature even there. It isn't really nature, but geographical setting, as she describes it. Notice her description on page 190 and 191. Now, having said all this, I hope made it somewhat clear to you, we must now come, in fact, to the revolt of youth. To the revolt against that co-optation, the search for immediacy. We shall proceed, I think, as follows. Then we shall start first with what I think was perhaps the most portentous movement called Expressionism, which includes Italian Futurism, to say. And then we shall go to Dedicate, who's not an Expressionist, and the attack of manners and morals. And then we shall go to what it meant, namely the rediscovery of the human body. Now you see this quest for immediacy. This quest for immediacy is going to address itself to everything that is called or thought of as hypocrisy, to all of this. But do not underestimate then the communication revolution. Railway travel, mass tourism, cyclism, and all of this would start as both a problem of co-optation to an ordered bourgeois society. I think we've done very well in the cyclist. And, on the other hand, a loss of immediacy, which you find in all literature and art at the end of the century. So next, on Wednesday, we go on.